This is about Peter?
This is about trying to get the world put together peacefully, permanently. This is about abolishing nations and the wars that just won't stop as long as people can pin their hopes on great heroes.
Then you should send me away too, or tell people I'm dead. I was in Ender's Jeesh.
Petra, you chose your path. You married. You had children. Bean's children. You decided that's what you wanted more than anything else. We've respected that. You have Bean's children. And you've had Bean almost as long as you would have had him if we had never intervened. Because he's dying. Our best guess is that he wouldn't make it another 6 months without going out into space and living weightlessly. We've done everything according to your choice.
It's true that they didn't actually requisition our babies, Bean said.
So live with your choices, Petra, said Rackham. Raise these babies, and help us do what we can to help Peter save the world from itself. The story of Bean's heroic death in the service of the FPE will help with that.
There'll be legends anyway, said Petra.
Plenty of dead heroes have legends. Yes, but if they know we put him in a starship and trundled him off into space, it won't be just a legend, will it? Serious people would believe in it, not just the normal lunatics.
So how will you even keep up the research project? Demanded Petra.
If everybody thinks the only people who need the cure are dead or never existed, why will it continue? Because a few people in the IF and Coleman will know, and they'll be in contact with Bean by Ansible. He'll be called home when the cure is found.
They flew on then, as Petra tried to deal with what they'd told her. Bean held her most of the time, even when her anger surged now and then and she was furious with him. Terrible scenarios kept playing themselves out in her mind, and at the risk of giving Bean ideas, she said to him, "Don't give up, Julian Delphiki. Don't decide that there's never going to be a cure and end the voyage. Even if you think your life is worthless, you have my babies out there, too. Even if the voyage goes on so long that you really are dying, remember that these children are like you. Survivors. As long as somebody doesn't actually kill them."
"Don't worry," said Bean. "If I had the slightest tendency toward suicide, we would never have met. And I would never do anything to endanger my own children. I'm only taking this voyage for them. Otherwise, I'd be content to die in your arms here on Earth."
She wept again for a while after that, and then she had to feed Ramon again. And then she insisted on feeding Ender and Bella herself, spooning the food into their mouths because when would she ever get a chance to do it again? She tried to memorize every moment of it, even though she knew she couldn't, knew that memory would fade, that these babies would become only a distant dream to her, that her arms would remember best the babies she held the longest, the children she would keep with her. The only one she had born from her own body would be gone. But she didn't cry while she was feeding them. That would have been a waste. Instead, she played with them and talked to them and teased them to talk back to her. "I know your first word isn't going to be too long from now. How about a little mama right now, you lazy baby?" It was only after the plane had landed in Rotterdam and Bean was supervising the nurses as they carried the babies down onto the tarmac that Petra stayed back in the plane with Rackham long enough to put her worst nightmare into words. "Don't think that I'm not aware of how easy it would be, Mazer Rackham, for this fake death of Bean's not to be a fake at all. For all we know, there is no ship. There is no project to find a cure, and Valescu is going to be executed. The threat of this new species replacing your precious human race would be gone then. And even the widow would be silent about what you've done to her husband and children, because she'll think he's off in space somewhere, traveling at light speed, instead of dead on a battlefield in Iran.
Rackham looked as if she had slapped him.
Petra, he said, what do you think we are?
What you are, said Petra,
is not denying it.
I deny it, said Rackham.
There is a ship. We are seeking a cure. We will call him home.
Then she saw the tears streaming down his cheeks.
Petra, said Rackham, don't you understand that we love your children? All of you? We already had to send Ender away. We're sending them all away except for you. Because we love you. Because we don't want any harm to you.
So why are you leaving me here?
Because of your babies, Petra. Because even though they don't have the syndrome, they're also Bean's babies. He's the only one who had no hope of a normal life. But thanks to you, he had one. However briefly, he got to be a husband and a father and have a family. Don't you know how much we love you for giving him that? As God is my witness, Petra, we would never harm Bean. Not for any cause, and certainly not for our convenience. Whatever you think we are, you're wrong. Because you children are the only children we have.
She wasn't going to feel sorry for him. It was her turn right now.
So she pushed past him and went down the stairs and took the hand of her husband and followed the nurses that were carrying her children toward a closed van. There were 5 new children that she hadn't met yet, waiting for her and Bean. Her life hadn't ended yet, even though it felt like she was dying with every breath she took.
Chapter 22, Rumors of War. From Graf, pilgrimage@colman.gov, to Peter Wiggin, private@freepeopleofearth.fp.gov. Ray, debriefing. Attached are the data to the division level, including names of commanders. But the gist is simple enough. Russia is gambling everything on the quiescence of Eastern Europe. They're all supposed to be terrified of a newly aggressive Russia. This is the move they thought they were going to be able to make when they had Achille with them and kidnapped all of Ender's Jeesh. What you can tell them with authority is this. Russia is newly aggressive. They are bent on proving they're a world power again. They're dangerous. But, 1. They don't have Vlad. They have his plan, but can't adapt to any changes. 2. We have Vlad's plan, so we can anticipate every move they make while they follow it. And the generals in command are going to follow it with religious devotion. Expect no flexibility, even after they know we have it. Vlad knows the men in command. In the Russian military these days, any leaders with the imagination to improvise don't rise to the level where it will matter. 3. Hunsu is being provided with their plan, so their main army will meet with disaster in the east. 4. They stripped their western defenses. A fast-moving army, competently led, should take St. Petersburg in a walk and Moscow in a week. That's Vlad's opinion. Bean has been over this information and concurs. He suggests you take Petra out of Armenia and put her in charge of the campaign in Russia.
When Suryawan got the word from Peter, he was ready. Prime Minister Paribatra and Minister of Defense Ambol had kept their affiliation with the FPE secret for just this occasion. Now, armed with Burmese and Chinese permission to pass through their territory, the Thai army was going to have the chance to face the Indians who had begun all this nonsense with their vicious, unprovoked invasion of Burma and Thailand. The troops went by train all the way into Chinese territory. Chinese trucks with Chinese drivers ferried them the rest of the way to the spots that Suri Yawang had mapped out as soon as Peter suggested it as a contingency. At the time, Peter had said, "It's a remote possibility, because it requires incredible stupidity on the part of some non-stupid people. But be ready." Ready to defend China. That was the irony. But Hanzu's China was not the China that had embraced a Shield's treacherous plan and crushed everyone, carrying away the entire Tai leadership and Suri Yawang's parents. Hanzu promised friendship, and Bean vouched for him. So Suri Yawang had been able to persuade his top leadership, and they had persuaded his men, that defending China was nothing more or less than a forward defense of Thailand. "China has changed," Suri Yawang told the officers, "but India has not. Once again, they're pouring over the border of a nation that believes itself to be at peace with them. This goddess they follow, Virlomi, she's just another battle school graduate like me. But we have what she doesn't have. We have Julian Delfiki's plan, and we will win." Bean's plan, however, was simple enough. The only way to end this once and for all is to make it a disaster. Like Varus's legions in the Teutoburgerwald. No guerrilla action, no chance of retreat. Virlomi alive if possible, but if she insists on dying, oblige her. That was the plan. But Suri Yawang needed no more than that. The mountainous country of southwestern China and northern Burma was ambush country. Virlomi's ill-trained troops were advancing on foot ridiculously slowly in three main columns, following three river valleys with three inadequate roads. Suri Yawang's own plans called for a simple, classical ambush on all three routes. He hid relatively small but heavily armed contingents at the heads of the valleys, where they would be passed by the Indian troops. Then, far, far down the valley, he had far larger contingents with plenty of transport to move up the valley upon command. Then it was a matter of waiting for two things. The first thing came on the second day of waiting. The southernmost outpost notified him that their column had entered the valley and was moving briskly. This was no surprise. They had had a much easier trip than the two northern armies. "They're not careful about probing ahead," said the general in charge of that contingent. "Raw troops, marching blind. As I watched them, I kept thinking this must be an attempt to deceive us. But no. They keep passing with large gaps in the line, stragglers, and only a few regiments that put out scouts. None of them came close to finding us. They haven't put a single observer on either ridge. They're lazy." When later in the day the other two hidden contingents reported a similar story, Suri Yawang relayed the information back to Ambul. While he waited for the next triggering event, he had his lookouts make a particular point of searching for any sign that Virlomi herself was traveling with any of the three armies. There was no mystery about it. She was traveling with the northernmost Indian army, riding in an open jeep, and the troops cheered when she passed, moving up and down the line, slowing down her own army's advance in the process since they had to move off the road for her. Suri Yawang heard this with sadness. She had been so brilliant. Her assessment of how to undo the Chinese occupation had been dead on. Her holding action to keep the Chinese from returning to India or resupplying when the Persians and Pakistanis invaded had been of Thermopylaean proportions. The difference was that Virlomi was more careful than the Spartans. She had already covered all the back roads. Nothing got past her Indian guerrillas. She was beautiful and wise and mysterious. Suri Yawang had rescued her once and cooperated in the little drama that made the rescue possible and played upon her reputation as a goddess. But in those days, she had known she was just acting. Or had she? Perhaps it was her intimations of godhood that had caused her to reject Suri Yawang's overtures of friendship and more than friendship. The blow had been painful, but he wasn't angry with her. She had an aura of greatness about her that he had seen in no other commander, not even Bean. The troop deployments she was showing here were not what he would have expected from the woman who had been so careful of her men's lives in all her previous actions, nor from the woman who had wept over the bodies of the victims of Muslim atrocities. Didn't she see that she was leading the soldiers to disaster? Even if there were no ambush in these mountains, though it was absolutely predictable that there would be, an army this ragged could be destroyed at will by a trained and determined enemy. As Euripides wrote, "Whom the gods would destroy, they first make mad." Ambul, knowing how Suriyawang felt about Virlomi, had offered to let him command only that part of the army that wouldn't face her directly, but Suri refused. Remember what Bean said Ender taught. To know the enemy well enough to defeat him requires that you know him so well you can't help but love him. Well, Suriyawang already loved this enemy, and knew her, well enough that he even thought he understood this madness. She wasn't vain. She never thought she'd survive, but all her plans kept succeeding. She couldn't believe that it was because of her own ability, so she thinks that she has some kind of divine favor. But it was her abilities and training, and she isn't using them now, and her army is going to pay for it. Suriyawang had left plenty of room for the Indians to move down the valleys before they reached the ambush. They weren't traveling at the same pace, so he had to make sure all three ambushes were sprung at the same time. He had to make sure all three armies passed through the top of the trap in their entirety. His instructions to his men were clear. Accept the surrender of any soldier who throws down his weapon and puts up his hands. Kill anyone who doesn't. But let no one out of the valley. All killed or captured. And Virlomi alive, if she lets us. Please let us, Virlomi. Please let us bring you back to reality. Back to life. Hanzo went among his troops. There was no nonsense about an invisible emperor. The soldiers of the Chinese army had chosen him and sustained his authority. He was theirs, and they would see him often, sharing their privations, listening to them, explaining to them. It was what he had learned from Ender. If you give orders and explain nothing, you might get obedience, but you'll get no creativity. If you tell them your purpose, then when your original plan is shown to be faulty, they'll find another way to achieve your goal. Explaining to your men doesn't weaken their respect for you. It proves your respect for them. So Hanzo explained, chatted, pitched in and helped, shared the meals of common soldiers, laughed at their jokes, listened to their complaints. One soldier had complained about how no one could sleep on ground like this. Hanzo promptly took over the man's tent and slept in it himself, exactly as it was, while the man took Hanzo's tent. In the morning, the man swore that Hanzo's bed was the worst one in the army, and Hanzo thanked him for his first good night's sleep in weeks. The story made its way through the army before nightfall. Hanzo's army did not love him any more than Virlomi's loved her, and there was no hint of worship in it. The key difference was that Hanzo had worked to train this army, had made sure that it was as well equipped as possible, and they knew the stories about the last war, when Hanzo had constantly warned his superiors about all their mistakes before they made them. The belief was that if Hanzo had been emperor all along, they would not have lost the lands they conquered. What they didn't understand was that if Hanzo had been their emperor, there would have been no conquests to lose, because a Xil would have been arrested the moment he entered China and turned over to the IF, under whose authority he had been confined to a mental hospital. There would have been no invasion of India and Southeast Asia, only a holding action to block the Indian invasion of Burma and Thailand. A real warrior hates war, Hanzo well understood. He had seen how devastated Ender was when he learned that the last game, the final exam, had been the real war, and that his enemy had been utterly destroyed by Ender's victory. So his men trusted him, as Hanzu kept retreating farther and farther into China, moving from one strong position to another, but never allowing his army to engage with the Russian invaders. He heard what the men said, the questions they asked. His answers were honest enough. The farther they come, the longer their supply lines. We want them so deep inside China that they can't get home again. Our army grows the deeper we move back into China, and theirs shrinks as they have to leave men behind to guard their route. And when they asked him about the rumors of a huge Indian army invading in the south, Hanzu only smiled and said, "The madwoman? The only Indian who ever conquered China was Gautama Buddha, and he did it with teachings, not artillery." What he couldn't tell them was that they were waiting for Peter Wiggin. Peter Wiggin stood in front of the microphones in Helsinki. Beside him stood the heads of government of Finland, Estonia, and Latvia. Aides were on secure cell phones connected to diplomats in Bangkok, Yerevan, Beijing, and many capitals in Eastern Europe. Peter smiled at the gathered reporters.
"At the request of the governments of Armenia and China, both of which were the victims of simultaneous unprovoked aggression by Russia, India, and the Muslim League of Caliph Ali, the free people of Earth have decided to intervene. We are joined in this effort by many new allies, many of which have agreed to hold plebiscites to determine whether or not to ratify the constitution of the FPE. Emperor Hanzu of China assures us that his armies are capable of dealing with the combined Russian and Turkish forces that are now operating well within the Chinese border in the north. In the south, Burma and China have opened their borders to safe passage for an army led by our old friend General Suryawan. Right now, in Bangkok, Prime Minister Paribatra is holding a press conference to announce that Thailand will hold a plebiscite on ratification, and that as of this moment, the Thai army is regarded as being under the provisional command of the FPE. In Armenia, where it is not possible to hold a press conference right now because of the exigencies of war, a nation under attack has turned to the FPE for help and leadership. I have placed the Armenian military under the direct command of Julian Delfiki, where they are resisting unprovoked Turkish and Russian aggression and have carried the war deep inside Muslim territory in Tabriz and Tehran. And here, in Eastern Europe, where Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Slovakia, Czechland, and Bulgaria had already joined the FPE, we are joined by our new allies, Poland, Romania, Hungary, Serbia, Austria, Greece, and Belarus. They have all repudiated the Warsaw Pact, which never obligated them to join in an offensive war in any event. Under the command of Petra Delfiki, the combined Allied armies are already making rapid progress toward capturing key targets inside Russia. They have met little resistance so far, but they are prepared to deal with any forces the Russians care to throw against them. We call upon the aggressors, Russia, India, and the Muslim League, to lay down their arms and accept an immediate ceasefire. If this offer is not accepted within the next 12 hours, then a ceasefire will only be accepted by us upon our terms and at a time of our choosing. The enemies of peace can expect to lose all the forces they have committed to this immoral war. I would now like to play for you a video that was recently recorded at a safe haven. In case you don't recognize him, since the Russians have kept him under wraps for many years now, the speaker is Vladimir Denisovich Porochkot, a citizen of Belarus who until several days ago was kept against his will in the service of a foreign power, Russia. You may also remember him as one of the team of young warriors who defeated the enemy that threatened the existence of the human race.
Peter stepped away from the microphone. The room was darkened. The screen wall came alive. There stood Vlad, in front of what looked like an ordinary office in an ordinary room on Earth. Only Peter knew that this was recorded in space, in the old Battle School space station, as a matter of fact, which was now the Ministry of Colonization.
I offer my apologies to the people of Armenia and China, whose borders were violated and citizens were killed by Russians who were using plans I created. I assumed that the plans were for contingency only, in response to aggression. I did not know that they would actually be used, and without the slightest provocation. As soon as I understood that this was how my work was to be used, I escaped from Russian custody and am now in a safe place where I can finally speak the truth. It came to my knowledge just before I left my captivity in Moscow that the leaders of Russia, India, and the Muslim League have divided up the world among them. To India will go all of Southeast Asia and most of China. To Russia will go part of China and all of Eastern and Northern Europe. To the Muslim League will go all of Africa and the Western European countries with large Muslim populations. I repudiate this plan. I repudiate this war. I refuse to let my work be used to enslave innocent people who did no harm and do not deserve to live under tyranny. Therefore, I have provided to the free people of Earth a complete knowledge of all the plans I drew up for Russian use. There is no movement they are now making which is not completely anticipated by the forces acting in concert with the FPE. And I urge the people of Belarus, my true homeland, to vote to join the free people of Earth. Who else has stood relentlessly against aggression and in favor of freedom and respect for every nation and every citizen? As for me, my talents and training are entirely geared toward warfare. I will no longer put my abilities at the service of any nation. I gave my childhood to fighting an alien enemy that was trying to destroy the human race. I did not fight off the buggers so that millions of humans could be slaughtered and hundreds of millions conquered and enslaved. I am on strike. I urge every other graduate of battle school except those who served the FPE to join me in that strike. Do not plan war. Do not wage war, except to help the hegemon Peter Wiggin to destroy the armies of the aggressors. And to the common soldiers, I say, do not obey your officers. Surrender at the first opportunity. Your obedience makes war possible. Take responsibility for your own actions and join me in my strike. If you surrender to the forces of the FPE, they will make every effort to spare your life and at the earliest opportunity to return you to your families. Again, I beg the forgiveness of those whose lives were lost because of plans I drew. Never again.
The video ended. Peter strode back to the microphone.
The free people of Earth and our allies are now at war with the aggressors. We have already told you everything we can say without compromising ongoing military operations. There will be no questions.
He walked away from the microphone.
Bean stood in the midst of the small wheeled beds that held his five normal children. The ones he would never see again, once he left them today. Mazer Rackham put a hand on his shoulder. It's time to go, Julian.
Five of them, said Bean. How will Petra manage?
She'll have help, said Rackham. The real question is, how will you manage on that messenger ship? They'll outnumber you 3-1. As I can attest, children with my particular genetic defect become self-sufficient at a very early age, said Bean. He touched the bed of the baby named Andrew. The same name as the eldest of the siblings. But this Andrew was a normal infant, not undersized for his age. And this second Bella, she would lead a normal life, as would Ramon and Julian and Petra. If these five are normal, Bean said to Rackham, then the ninth child, it's most likely defective? If the odds are 50-50 of the traits getting passed on, and we know that five of the nine didn't get them,
Then it stands to reason that the missing one has a higher likelihood of having the traits. Though, as any expert on probability would tell you, the probability for each child was 50-50, and the distribution of the syndrome among the other infants will have no effect on the outcome for the ninth. Maybe it's better if Petra never finds the last one. My guess, Bean, is that there is no ninth baby. Not every implantation works. There could easily have been an early miscarriage. That would be a complete explanation of the lack of any record that was traceable by the software. I don't know whether to be comforted or appalled that you would think I'd find that the death of one of my children might be comforting. Rackham grimaced. You know what I meant. Bean took an envelope from his pocket and laid it under Ramon. Tell the nurses to leave that envelope there, even if he leaks and wets all over the thing. Of course, said Rackham. For what it's worth, Bean, your pension will also be invested like Ender's and run by the same software. Don't, said Bean. Give it all to Petra. She'll need it with five babies to raise. Maybe six someday. What about when you come home? When they find the cure? Bean looked at him as if he were crazy. Do you really think that will happen? If you don't, why are you going? Because it might, said Bean. And if we stay here, early death is certain for all four of us. If the cure is found, and if we come home, then we can talk about a pension. I'll tell you what. After Petra dies, after these five all grow old and die, then start paying my pension into a fund controlled by that investor software. You'll be back before then. No, said Bean. No, that's... No. Once we're 10 years out, and there's no hope of a cure before that, then even if you find the cure, don't call us back until... Well, until Petra would be dead before we got here. Do you understand? Because if she remarries, and I want her to, I don't want her to have to face me. To face me looking as I do right now, the boy she married, the giant boy. This is cruel enough, what we're doing now. I'm not going to cause her one last torment before she dies. Why don't you let her decide? It's not her choice, said Bean. Once we leave, we're dead. Gone forever. She can never have back the life that will have been lost. But I'm not worried, Mazer. There is no cure. You know that? I know Valescu. He doesn't want to find a cure. He doesn't think it's a disease. He thinks it's the hope of humanity. And except for Anton, nobody else knows enough to proceed. It was an illegal field of study for too long. It's still tainted. The methods Valescu used, the whole process surrounding Anton's key. Nobody's going to turn that key again, and therefore you're not going to have any scientists who know what they're doing in that area. The project will have less and less importance for your successors. Someday, not too long from now, somebody will look at the budget item and say, we're paying for what? And the project will die. It won't happen, said Mazer. The fleet doesn't forget its own. Bean laughed. You don't get it, do you? Peter is going to succeed. The world is going to be united. International war will end. And along with it, the sense of loyalty among the military will also die. There'll just be colony ships and trading ships and scientific research institutes that will be scandalized at the thought of wasting money doing a personal favor for a soldier who lived 100 years ago. Or 200. Or 300. The funding won't be contingent, said Rackham. We're funding it using the same investment software. It's really good, Bean. This is going to be one of the best funded projects ever in a few years. Bean laughed. Mazer, you just don't understand how far people will go to get their hands on money that they think is being wasted on pure research. You'll see. But no, I take that back. You won't see. It'll happen after you're dead. I'll see. And I'll raise a glass to you, among my little children, and I'll say, here's to you, Mazer Rackham, you foolish old optimist. You thought humans were better than they are, which is why you went to all the trouble of saving the human race a couple of times. Mazer put an arm around Bean's waist and clinched tight for a moment. Kiss the babies goodbye. I will not, said Bean. Do you think I want them to have nightmares of a giant bending over them and trying to eat them? Eat them? Babies fear being eaten, said Bean. There's a sound evolutionary reason for it, considering that in our ancestral homeland in Africa, hyenas would always have been happy to carry off a human baby and eat it. I guess you've never read the child-rearing literature. Sounds more like Grimm's fairy tales. Bean walked from bed to bed, touching each child in return. Perhaps spending a little longer with Ramon, since he had spent so much time with him, compared to mere minutes with the others. Then he left the room and followed Rackham out to the enclosed van that was waiting for him.
Suriyawong heard the report and the order. The press conference has been held. Thai participation in the FPE has been announced. Now begin active operations against the enemy. Suri timed the departure of all six contingents so that they would arrive simultaneously, more or less. He also ordered the Chinese battle choppers into position, ready to join in the battle as soon as surprise was achieved. One of them would take him to where Virlomi would be. If there are any gods looking out for her, thought Suriyawang, then let her live. Even if 100,000 soldiers die for her pride, please let her live. The good she did, the greatness in her, should count for something. The mistakes of generals can kill many thousands, but they're still mistakes. She set out for victory, not destruction. She should be punished only for her intent, not the result. Not that her intent was all that good. But you gods of war, Shiva, you destroyer, what was Virlomi ever except your servant? Will you let your servant be destroyed solely because she was so good at her job?
St. Petersburg had fallen more quickly than anyone expected. The resistance hadn't even been enough to count as token. Even the police had fled, and the Finns and Estonians ended up working to maintain public order rather than fight a determined enemy. But that was all just a matter of reports to Petra, who was improvising her way across Russia. Without a huge air force, there was no way to airlift her army of Brazilians and Rwandans to Moscow, so she was bringing them in on passenger trains, carefully watching from what looked like recreational aircraft so she'd know as soon as there was any kind of problem. The heavier ordnance was being carried on the highway by big Polish and German moving vans, of the kind that plied the highways across Europe all the time, stopping only to eat and pee and visit roadside whores. Now they carried the war that the Russians had begun straight to Moscow. If the enemy was determined, they would be able to track Petra's army's progress. After all, there was no concealing what the trains were carrying as they raced through stations without stopping and demanded that the tracks be cleared in front of them, or we'll blast you and your station and your stupid little village of baby-killing Russians to smithereens! All rhetoric. A single telephone pole dropped across the tracks here and there would have slowed them down considerably. And they weren't about to start killing civilians. But the Russians didn't know that. Peter had told her that Vlad was sure the commanders who were left in Moscow would panic. They're runners, not fighters. That doesn't mean nobody will fight, but it will be local people, scattered. Wherever you meet resistance, just go around. If the Russian army in China is stopped, and international vids show Moscow and St. Petersburg in your hands, either the government will sue for peace or the people will revolt, or both. Well, it had worked for the Germans in France in 1940. Why not here? The loss of Vlad had a devastating effect on Russian morale, especially because the Russians all knew that Julian Delfiki himself had planned the counterattack and Petra Arkanian was leading the army that was sweeping across Russia. More like chugging across Russia. At least it wasn't winter.
Hanzu gave the orders, and his retreating troops moved to their positions. He had timed his retreat exactly right to lure the Russians to the exact spot he needed them to reach at the exact time he wanted them there, well ahead of Vlad's original schedule, the only deviation from his plan. The satellite information forwarded to him by Peter Wiggin assured him that the Turks had withdrawn westward, heading toward Armenia, as if they could get there in time to make any difference at all. Khalif Ali had apparently not solved the perpetual problem of Muslim armies. Unless they were under iron control, they were easily distracted. Ali was supposed to be that control. It made Hanzu wonder if Ali was even in command anymore. No matter. Hanzu's objective was the huge, overextended, weary Russian army that was still rigidly following Vlad's plan, despite the fact that their pincer movements had encountered an empty Beijing, with no Chinese forces to crush or Chinese government to seize. And despite the fact that panicky reports must be coming from Moscow, as they kept hearing rumors of Petra's advance without knowing where she was. The Russian commander he was facing was not wrong to persist in his campaign. Petra's advance on Moscow was ultimately cosmetic, as Petra no doubt knew, designed to cause panic, but without sufficient force to hold any objective for long. In the south, too, Suri's Thai army would do important work, but India's army wasn't a serious threat in the first place. Bean in Armenia had drawn off the Turkish armies, but they could easily come back. Everything came down to this battle. As far as Hanzu was concerned, it had better not be a battle at all. They were in the wheatfield country near Jinan. Vlad's plan assumed that the Chinese would seize the high ground to the southeast of the Huanghe and dispute the river crossing. Therefore, the Russians were prepared with portable bridges and rafts to move across the river at unexpected places and then surround the supposed Chinese redoubt. And, just as Vlad's plan predicted, Hanzu's forces were indeed gathered on that high ground and were shelling the approaching Russian troops with reassuring ineffectiveness. The Russian commander had to feel confident, especially when he found the bridges over the Huanghe ineptly destroyed, so repairs were quick. Hanzu couldn't afford to have a grinding battle, matching gun for gun, tank for tank. Too much materiel had been lost in the previous wars, and while Han's soldiers were battle-hardened veterans and the Russian army hadn't fought in years, Han's inability to get his army back to full material strength in the short time he had been emperor would inevitably be decisive. Han was not going to use human waves to overwhelm the Russians with numbers. He couldn't afford to waste this army. He had to keep it intact to deal with the much more dangerous Muslim armies, should they get their act together and join in the war. The Russian drones were easily a match for the Chinese. Both commanders would have an accurate picture of the battlefield. This was wheatfield country, perfect for the Russian tanks. Nothing Hanzu did could possibly surprise his enemy. Vlad's plan was going to work. The Russian commander had to be sure of it. His forces that had been concealed behind the Russian advance now reported that the last of the Russians had passed the checkpoints without realizing what the small red tags on fences, bushes, trees, and signposts signified. For the next 40 minutes, Hanzu's army had only one task: to confine the Russian army between those little red flags and the highlands across the Huang, while none of the Chinese army strayed into that zone. Didn't the Russians notice that every single civilian had been evacuated? That not a civilian vehicle was to be found? That the houses had been emptied of belongings? Hiram Graff had once taught a class in which he told them that God would teach them how to destroy their enemy using the forces of nature. His prime example was the way God used a flood of the Red Sea to destroy Pharaoh's chariots. The little red flags were the high water mark. Hanzu gave the order for the dam to be blown up. It would take the wall of water 40 minutes to reach the Russian army and destroy it. The Armenian soldiers had achieved all their objectives. They had forced a panicky Iranian government to demand the recall of their troops from India. Soon an overwhelming force would arrive, and they would all be lost. They thought, when the three black choppers came flying low over the city, that their time had come. Instead, the soldiers that emerged from the choppers were Thais in the uniform of the FPE, the original strike force trained by Bean and led in so many raids by him or Suryawang. Then Bean himself stepped out of the chopper. "Sorry I'm late," he said. Within minutes, the FPE troops had secured the perimeter, and the Armenian troops were embarking on the choppers. "You're going to be taking the long way home," one of the Thais said, laughing. Bean made a big deal about how he was going to go down the hill to see how things were going with the forward defense. The Armenians watched as Bean ducked to go through the door of a half-bombed-out building. A few moments later, the building blew up. Nothing left standing. No walls, no chimney, and no Bean. The chopper took off then. The Armenians were so happy to have been rescued that it was hard to remember the terrible news they were going to have to take to Petra Arkanian. Her husband was dead. They'd seen it. There was no way anyone in that building could have survived.
Chapter 23, Colonist. From Black Dog, Salam at ICamanon.com, to Graf, Pilgrimage at Kalman.gov. Encrypted using code, decrypted using code. Ray, Vlad's farewell message. Why I'm writing to you from hiding should be obvious. I'll give you the detailed story at a later date. I want to take you up on your invitation, if it's still open. I learned recently that while I'm a real whiz at military strategy, I'm a dimwit about what motivates my own people, even those I thought were closest to me. For instance, who would have guessed that they would hate a modernizing, consensus-building black African caliph a lot more than they hated a dictatorial, idolatrous, immodest Hindu woman? I was going to simply disappear from history and was feeling quite sorry for myself in my exile while grieving for a dear friend who gave his life to save mine in Hyderabad, when I realized that the news reports that endlessly replayed Vlad's message were showing me what I needed to do. So, I've made arrangements to make a vid inside a nearby mosque, in a country where I'll be safe showing my face, so don't worry. I'm not going to let this one be released through you or Peter. That would discredit it immediately. It's going to move out through Muslim channels only. The thing I realized is this. I may have lost the support of the military, but I'm still caliph. It's not just a political office, it's also a religious one. And not one of those clowns has the authority to depose me. Meanwhile, I know now what they called me behind my back. Black Dog. They're going to hear those words back from me, you can be sure. When the vid is released, then I'll let you know where I am, if you're still willing to take me.
Randy watched the news reports avidly. It seemed so hopeful at first, when they heard that Julian Delficki had been killed in Iran. Maybe the enemies hunting her baby would be crushed, and she'd be able to come out in the open and proclaim that she was carrying Ashil's son and heir. But then she realized the evil in this world would not die just because a few of Ashil's enemies were killed or defeated. They had done too good a job of demonizing him. If they knew who her son was, he would at least be scrutinized and tested constantly. At worst, they would take him away from her, or kill him. They'd stop at nothing to erase Ashil's legacy from the earth. Randy stood by her son's little traveling bed in the former motel room that now was as cheap a one-room hot plate apartment as Northern Virginia offered. A traveling bed was all he needed. He was so small. His birth had taken her by surprise, months too early, and he came so fast. She couldn't get to a hospital. Not that they would have taken her. She was in the midst of changing her identity. She had no health insurance. But because he was so small, the birth was easy. He just came out. And small as he was, he didn't have any problems. He didn't even look like one of those premature babies, the ones who looked so fetal, fish-like. Not her boy. He was beautiful, completely normal-looking. Just small. Small and brilliant. It almost frightened her sometimes. He had said his first word just a couple of days ago. Mama, of course. Who else did he know? And when she spoke to him, explained things to him, told him about his father, he seemed to be listening intently. He seemed to understand. Was that possible? Of course it was. Ashil's child would be wiser than normal. And if he was small, well, Ashil himself had been born with a twisted foot, an abnormal body to contain extraordinary gifts. Secretly, she had named the baby Ashil Flandre II. But she was careful. She didn't write that name anywhere but in her heart. Instead, the birth certificate called him Randall Firth. She was going by the name Nichelle Firth now. The real Nichelle Firth was a retarded woman in a special school where she had worked as an aide. Randy looked old enough, she knew, to pass for the right age. Being on the run and working so hard and worrying all the time gave her a kind of tired look that aged her. But what did she care about vanity? She wasn't trying to attract a man. She knew men well enough to know that none of them would want to marry a woman only to have her spend all her care on another man's baby. So she made herself up only enough to be hireable in decent jobs that didn't require a long resume. They'd say, "Where have you worked before?" And she'd say, "Nothing since college. They wouldn't even remember me. I was a stay-at-home mom, but my husband wasn't a sleep-at-home guy. So here I am, no resume except my baby's healthy and my house is clean, and I know how to work like my life depended on it, 'cause now it does." That line got her hired anywhere she bothered to apply. She'd never be an executive, but she didn't want to be. Just put in her hours, get Randall out of daycare, and then talk to him, sing to him, and study about how to be a good mother and raise a healthy, confident baby who would have the strength of character to overcome the bigotry against his father and take on the whole world. But these wars, and Peter Wiggins' hideous face on the camera announcing this nation was now in the FPE and that nation was allied with the FPE, it worried her. She couldn't hide forever. Her fingerprints couldn't be changed, and there was that shoplifting arrest when she was in college. It was so stupid. She really had sort of forgotten that she took the thing. If she'd remembered, she would have changed her mind and paid for it, like the other times. But she forgot, and they stopped her outside the store, so she had actually done the theft, they said, and she wasn't a minor, so she got the whole arrest treatment. They let her off, but her prints were in the system. So someday, somebody would know who she really was. And the man who approached her, who gave her Ashil's baby, how could she be sure he wouldn't tell them? Between what he told them and her fingerprints, they could find her no matter how often she changed her name. That was when she decided that for the first time in human history, when a person was not safe anywhere on Earth, he had somewhere else to go. Why should her little Ashil Flandre II be raised here in hiding, with bloodthirsty monsters out to kill him in order to punish his father for being better than them? when instead he could grow up on a clean new colony world where no one would care that the baby wasn't really hers or that he was small, if he was smart and worked hard and she raised him right. They promised that there would be trade back and forth between colony worlds and visits from starships. When the time was right for Ashiel II to claim his heritage, his legacy, his throne, she would bring him aboard one of those starships, and they'd come back to Earth. She had studied the relativistic effects of star travel. It might be as much as 100 years or more, 50 years out and 50 years back, say. But it would only be 3 or 4 years of voyaging. So all of Ashiel's enemies would be long since dead. Nobody would bother spreading vicious lies about him anymore. The world would be ready to hear of him with fresh ears, with open minds. She couldn't leave him alone in the apartment. It was a drizzly afternoon, though. Was it worth risking him catching cold? She bundled him well and carried him in a sling in front of her. He was so small, it felt like he was lighter than her purse. Her umbrella shielded them both from the rain. They'd be fine. It was a long walk to the metro station, but that was the best and the driest way to get to the liaison office of the Ministry of Colonization, where she could sign up. That would be a risk, of course. They might fingerprint her. They might run a check. But surely they knew that many people would choose to go on a colony ship because they needed to get away from their old lives. And if they found that she had changed her name, the shoplifting arrest might explain it. She had been drifting into crime and, what would they assume, drugs, probably. But now she wanted a fresh start, under a new name. Or maybe she should use her real name. No, because under that name she had no baby. And if they questioned whether Randall was really hers and ran a genetic test, they'd find that he had none of her genes. They'd wonder where she had kidnapped him. He was so small they'd think he was a newborn. And the birth had been so easy, there'd been no tearing. Did they have tests to determine if she had ever given birth? Nightmares, nightmares. No, she'd give them her new name and then be prepared to run if they came looking for her. What else could she do? It was worth the risk to get him off planet. On the way to the metro, she walked past a mosque, but there were cops outside directing traffic. Had there been a bombing? Those were happening in other places, Europe, she kept hearing, but not in America, surely. Not lately, anyway. No, not a bombing, just a speaker. Just Khalif Alai. She heard someone say it, almost as if they had been speaking to her. Khalif Alai, the one man on Earth who seemed to have the courage to stand against Peter Wiggin. Luckily, she had a scarf over her head. She looked Muslim enough for this secular town, where plenty of Muslims wore no special clothing at all. Nobody challenged her, a woman with a baby, though they did make everybody leave things like umbrellas and purses and jackets at the security counter. She walked into the women's section of the mosque. She was surprised at how the carved and decorated latticework interfered with her ability to see what was going on in the men's part of the mosque. Apparently, even liberal American mosques still thought women did not need to see the speaker for themselves. Randy had heard about such things, but the only church she had ever attended was Presbyterian, and families sat together there. There were cameras all over the men's section, so maybe the view from here was as good as most men were getting. She wasn't converting to Islam anyway, she just wanted to catch a glimpse of Khalif Alai. He was speaking in common, not Arabic. She was glad of that. I remain Khalif, no matter where I live. I will take with me in my colony only Muslims who believe in Islam as a religion of peace. I leave behind me the bloodthirsty false Muslims who called their Khalif a black dog and tried to murder me so they could make war on their harmless neighbors. Here is the law of Islam from the time of Muhammad and forever. God gives permission to go to war only when we are attacked by an enemy. As soon as a Muslim raises his hand against an enemy who has not attacked him, then he is not engaged in jihad. He has become shaitan himself. I declare that all those who plotted the invasion of China and Armenia are not Muslims, and any good Muslim who finds these men must arrest them. From now on, Muslim nations may only be governed by leaders who were freely elected. Non-Muslims may vote in these elections. It is forbidden to molest any non-Muslim, even if he used to be a Muslim, or deprive him of any of his rights, or put him at any disadvantage. And if a Muslim nation votes to join the free people of earth and abide by its constitution, that is permitted by God. There is no offense in it. Randy was heartsick. This was just like Vlad's speech. A complete capitulation to Peter Wiggins' phony ideals. They had apparently blackmailed or drugged or frightened even Khalif Ali. She picked her way carefully over and around the women seated and standing and leaning in the packed women's chamber. Many of them looked at her as if she were sinning by leaving. Many others were looking toward Khalif Ali with love and longing. "Your love is misplaced," thought Randy. "Only one man was pure in his embrace of power, and that was my Achille." And to one woman who glared at her with special ferocity, Randy pointed to baby Achille's diaper and made a face. The woman at once relaxed her grimace. Of course, the baby had messed himself. A woman had to take care of her baby even before she heard the words of the Caliph. "If the Caliph cannot stand against Peter Wiggin, then there is nowhere on earth for me to raise my son." She walked the rest of the way to the metro as the rain came down harder and harder. Her umbrella did its job, though, and the baby stayed dry. Then she was in the metro station, and the rain had stopped. That's how it will be in space. All the sheltering of this baby will be needless then. I can put away the umbrella, and he will have nothing to fear. And on the new world, he can walk in the open, in the light of a new sun, like the free spirit he was born to be. When he returns to Earth, he will be a great man, towering over these moral dwarfs. By then, Peter Wiggin will be dead, like Julian Delficki. That's the only disappointment, that my son will never be able to face his father's murderers directly.
Chapter 24. Sacrifice. From Mosca. Molo at philmill.gov.ph. To Graf. Pilgrimage at Coleman.gov. Ray, my ticket. Just when things were getting interesting here on Earth, I keep getting this nagging feeling that you were right. I hate it when that happens. They came to me today, excited as babies. Petra took Moscow with a ragtag army traveling by passenger train. Hunzu wiped out the entire Russian army without taking more than a few dozen casualties. Bean was able to decoy the Turkish forces toward Armenia and keep them from getting involved in China. And of course, Bean also gets the credit for Sir Yawang's victory in China. Everybody wants to assign all glory to the boys and girl of Ender's Jeesh. You know what they wanted from me? I'm supposed to conquer Taiwan. No joke. I'm supposed to draw up the plans, because you see, my poor little ragtag island nation has me, Jeesh Boy, and that makes them a great power. How dare those Muslim troops remain on Taiwan? I pointed out that now that Hunzu had won against the Russians and the Muslims probably wouldn't dare attack, he'd probably be looking to put Taiwan back in his fold. And even if he didn't, did they really think Peter Wiggin would sit idly by while the Philippines committed an act of unprovoked aggression against Taiwan? They wouldn't listen. It was, "Do as you're told, genius boy." So, what's left for me, Hiram? I feel so wicked calling you by your first name. Do as Vlad did, and draw up their plans and let them fall into their own pit? Do as Ali did, and repudiate them openly and call for revolution? That is what he did, isn't it? Or do as Han did, and stage an internal coup, and become emperor of the Philippines and master of the Tagalog-speaking world? I don't want to leave my home. But there's no peace for me on Earth. I'm not sure I want the burden of running a colony, but at least I won't be drawing up blueprints for death and oppression. Just don't put me in the same colony with Ali. He thinks he's so the man because he's the successor of the prophet.
Even the tanks had been washed downstream, some of them for kilometers. Where the Russians had been spreading out for their offensive against Hansa's forces on the high ground, there was nothing. Not a sign that they had been there. Not a sign that the villages and fields had been there either. It was a muddy version of the moon. Except for a couple of deep-rooted trees, there was nothing. It would take a long time and a lot of work to restore this land. But now there was work to do. First, they had to glean the survivors, if there were any, from the countryside downstream. Second, they had to clean up the corpses and gather up the tanks and other vehicles, and, most importantly, the live armaments. And Hanzu had to swing a large part of his army north to retake Beijing and sweep away whatever remnants of the Russian invasion might be left behind. Meanwhile, the Turks might decide to come back. The work of war wasn't over yet. But the grinding, bloody campaign he had feared, the one that would tear China apart and bleed a generation to death, that had been averted, both here and in the north, and in the south as well. And then what? Emperor of China, indeed. What would the people expect? Now that he had won this great victory, was he supposed to go back and subjugate the Tibetans again? Force the Turkic speakers of Xinjiang back under the Chinese heel? Spill Chinese blood on the beaches of Taiwan to satisfy old claims that the Chinese had some inherent right to rule over the racially Malay majority on that island? And then invade any nation that mistreated its Chinese minorities? Where would it stop? In the jungles of Papua? Back in India? Or at the old western border of Genghis's empire, the lands of the Golden Horde on the steppes of Ukraine? What frightened him most about these scenarios was that he knew he could do it. He knew that with China he had a people with the intelligence, the vigor, the resources, and unified will. Everything a ruler needed to go out into the world and make everything he saw his own. And because it was possible, there was a part of him that wanted to play it out, see where this path led. I know where it leads, thought Hanzu. It leads to Virlomi leading her pathetic army of half-armed volunteers to certain death. It leads to Julius Caesar bleeding to death on the floor of the Senate, muttering about how he was betrayed. It leads to Adolf and Eva, dead in an underground bunker while their empire crumbles in explosions above their corpses. Or it leads to Augustus, casting about him for a successor, only to realize that it all has to be handed over to his revolting pervert of a stepson? What was Tiberius, really? A sad statement about how empires are inevitably led. Because what rises to the top in an empire are the bureaucratic infighters, the assassins, or the warlords. Is that what I want for my people? I became emperor because that's how I could bring down Snow Tiger and keep him from killing me first. But China doesn't need an empire. China needs a good government. The Chinese people need to stay home and make money or travel through the world and make even more money. They need to do science and create literature and be part of the human race. They need to have no more of their sons die in battle. They need to have no more of them cleaning up the bodies of the enemy. They need peace.
The news of Bean's death spread slowly out of Armenia. It came to Petra, incredibly enough, on her cell phone in Moscow, where she was still directing her troops in the complete takeover of the city. The news of Han's devastating victory had reached her, but not the general public. She needed to be in complete control of the city before the people learned of the disaster. She needed to make sure they could contain the reaction. It was her father on the telephone. His voice was very husky, and she knew at once what he was calling to tell her. "The soldiers who were rescued from Tehran, They came back by way of Israel. They saw... Julian didn't come back with them. Petra knew perfectly well what had happened, and, more to the point, what Bean would have made sure people thought they had seen happen. But she let the scene play out, saying the lines expected of her. They left him behind? There was nothing to bring back. A sob. It was good to know that her father had come to love Bean. Or maybe he only wept in pity for his daughter, already widowed, and only barely a woman. He was caught in the explosion of a building. The whole thing was vaporized. He could not have lived.
Thank you for telling me, Father.
I know it's... What about the babies? Come home, pet. When I'm through with the war, Father, then I'll come home and grieve for my husband and care for my babies. They're in good hands now. I love you. And Mother. I'll be all right. Goodbye. She cut off the connection. Several officers around her looked at her questioningly. What she had said about grieving for her husband. This is top secret information, she said to the officers. It would only encourage the enemies of the free people. But my husband was... He entered a building in Tehran, and it blew up. No one in that building could possibly have survived. They did not know her. These Finns, Estonians, Lithuanians, Latvians. Not well enough to say more than a heartfelt, but inadequate, I'm sorry. We have work to do, she said, relieving them of the responsibility to care for her. They could not know that what she was showing was not iron self-control, but cold rage. To lose your husband in war, that was one thing. But to lose him because he refused to take you with him... That was unfair. In the long run, she would have decided the same way. There was one baby unfound, and even if that baby was dead or had never existed, how do they know how many there were except what Valescu told them? The 5 normal babies shouldn't have their lives so drastically deformed. It would be like making a healthy twin spend his life in a hospital bed just because his brother was in a coma. I would have chosen the same if I'd had time. There was no time. Bean's life was too fragile already. She was losing him. And she had known right from the start that one way or another she would lose him. When he begged her not to marry him, when he insisted he wanted no babies, it was to avoid having her feel as she felt now. Knowing it was her own fault, her own free choice, all for the best, it didn't ease the pain one bit. If anything, it made it worse. So she was angry. At herself, at human nature, at the fact that she was a human and therefore had to have that nature whether she wanted it or not. The desire to have the babies of the best man she knew, the desire to hold on to him forever, and the desire to go into battle and win, outwitting her enemies, cutting them off, taking all their power away from them, and standing astride them in victory. It was a terrible thing to realize about herself, that she loved the contest of war every bit as much as she missed her husband and children, so that doing the one would take her mind off the loss of the others.
When the gunfire began, Verlomi felt a thrill of excitement, but also a sick sense of dread, as if she knew some terrible secret about this campaign that she had not allowed herself to hear until the gunfire brought the message to her consciousness. Almost at once, Her driver tried to take her out of harm's way, but she insisted on heading toward the thick of the fighting. She could see where the enemy was gathered, in the hills on either side. She immediately recognized the tactics that were being used. She started to issue orders. She ordered them to notify the other two columns to withdraw up their valleys and reconnoiter. She sent her elite troops, the ones that had fought with her for years, up the slopes to hold the enemy off while she withdrew the rest of her troops. But the mass of untrained soldiers were too frightened to understand their orders or execute them under fire. Many of them broke and ran, straight up the valley where they were exposed to fire. And Verlomi knew that not far behind them would be the trailing force which they had carelessly passed by. All because she didn't expect Hunsu, preoccupied with the Russians, to be able to send a force of any size here to the south.